Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Somewhat intimidating looking audience. And I will try to do some of the things that David was promising. David always goes a little bit over the top in his promises, but I will try to live up to it. Okay, so it's election season, and this is a memory test. Who remembers who Admiral Stockdale was? A small fraction of the audience. He was Ross Perot's running mate back in whatever it was, 1988. And there was a debate between the vice presidential candidates. And he was at the podium. And the first thing he says is, who am I and why am I here? So I used to be a theoretical particle physicist, as David said. And I wrote papers with titles that will be total jargon. If we went back far enough, they would be perhaps somewhat less jargon. But about 10 years ago, as he said, I started writing papers that had titles like precise physical models of protein-DNA interaction from high-throughput data, quantifying selection and immune receptor repertoires, and so on. In other words, I started trying to do something that had something to do with biology, trying to make use of whatever it was that I had as a physicist that could be useful in this domain. I'm occasionally asked why I did this. Why did I switch to biology? Well, it wasn't really because of any dissatisfaction with mainstream theoretical physics. It was simply that I had colleagues, physicists, who were in fact pioneering a new field. And the two who had the most influence on me were Bill Bialik and Stan Leibler. And basically, they showed me that biology poses fascinating questions for theory and that the time is ripe for attacking them. And so just as an intellectual adventurer, I wanted to follow along. And also as a department chair and somebody responsible for the future of an institution, I felt this was something I should get into to help my institution exploit the opportunities to be even better in the future than they were at the time. Now, in thinking about tonight's talk, on reflection, it seems to me that both biology and theoretical physics in a certain way have come to a crisis, independently and kind of fortuitously at the same time, that offers opportunities for both subjects. So that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. I will try to explain what I mean by this and give you some concrete notion of what theoretical physicists are doing to respond. By the by, I'm here in Santa Barbara for a few weeks as part of the quantitative immunology program. And interestingly enough, the people who are there are largely theoretical physicists or people from a theoretical physics background. Of course, we are kept in order and kept on the right track by real biologists who really know the facts about immunology. And anything in biology is extremely complex. And as I'll say in various ways, the real problem is to figure out how to simplify the complexity without throwing out the real thing. And can you do this? At any rate, I hope my talk might explain a bit about why KITP is hosting such an event. Okay, so since I'm talking about theoretical physics and the future thereof, I have to remind you, I'm going to tell you what I mean by theoretical physics, and what I mean by it is what David and I both thought it was all about when we were children. It's a hugely ambitious attempt to basically describe everything about the physical universe, how matter behaves in all of the various conditions that it finds itself in the universe, and as things turned out, how the universe came into being, what is the history thereof, and how does it fit with, or how do you use the underlying laws to explain and understand it. It has been remarkably successful in the last 50 years, the last century, the last three centuries, but really things have accelerated to an extraordinary extent in recent times, maybe in our lifetime, I would say. Theoretical physics comprehends a lot, but some things escape its net for the moment, and so I have a little graphic here to indicate the evolution of us from some primate predecessor, just to symbolize life. Okay, so what is the primary task of theoretical physics, as those of us who share this kind of heritage belief. So we say the fundamental, the primary task is to discover the fundamental mathematically expressed laws of nature and the stuff to understand or come to some decision about the stuff that obeys those laws in our universe. I mean, one of the things we come to realize is that, well, we are a very particular universe, and the laws that our stuff obeys are well specified and precise, but there are various things where somebody made a choice, and it could have been different. Okay, that's why I say in our universe, one can imagine others. These laws are valid within broad domains of phenomena and are, in some sense, simple. You know, you can write some of them pretty handily on a postcard in shorthand form, and most people know something about what these laws are as they were discovered. We began in the 17th century with Newtonian mechanics and the gravitational force law. 150 years later, Maxwell and associates uncovered the equations of electricity and magnetism that governs the electric and magnetic field, and they have within them special relativity, so you might include that there. Some 50 years later, Einstein's general relativity came to pass and basically conveyed the message that gravity is actually the dynamics of geometry, and that presumably is what we're going to hear about tomorrow, direct evidence that the wiggling of, how shall I put it, there is a wiggling of the geometry of space and space-time that's associated with gravitational effects. Shortly thereafter, the quantum mechanics of electrons, atoms, and molecules. And I would say, finally, the thing that happened in our history as physicists is quantum field theory and the standard model of everything, which has been completed with Big Bang cosmology and a theory of the origin of our universe. So the culmination of this development, the outcome of an explosion of discovery over the last 50 years, is what we please ourselves to call the standard model of our world. It's a precise mathematical theory whose scope is, well, pretty much everything. And some modesty is, of course, in order, but a victory lap or two, I think, for humankind and scientific humankind is definitely justified. Okay, so maybe I should just, since this is a general talk, tell you a little bit about, well, what is the standard model that I'm talking about tell us about our world? When David and I entered the world of physics 50-odd years ago, there was no agreement on the fundamental nature of matter. He came from the West Coast school, and I came from the East Coast school, and they were very different in their thoughts about how that might work. No agreement on the physical theory governing that matter or how the universe worked. So over time, a picture and theory of matter in the universe came together on two tracks. So the track one was the particle physics track, the things that one discovers by building accelerators and smashing the things that you have available to you together to see what comes out. And you know, over time, what emerged from that was a specific quantum field theory of the strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions between three generations of point-like quarks and leptons with forces mediated by gauge bosons and with a Higgs boson doing symmetry breaking and mass generation. I don't have the time, and we don't have the mathematical equipment to write out the actual equations right now, but I can give you a kind of a quick family portrait of the standard model of particle physics. It's the things which put together in various ways make the universe that we live in. They're called quarks up here, and then there are leptons. Leptons from the Greek root for light. These are light particles. In fact, the neutrinos are almost massless. The quarks are called quarks because Murray Gell-Mann had a kind of quirky mind and invented some very good names. They come in patterns. They come in generations. There's the first generation, which everybody is fairly light. There's a second generation of quarks and leptons that are heavier. And there's a third generation, which is very heavy. The heaviest of the quarks is the top, and it weighs about 173 times the mass of the proton. You'll notice the proton is not on here, and the neutron is not on here. That's because protons and neutrons are made out of these constituent quarks. We have a very specific quantum field theory of how these guys interact. And the quarks are not seen directly. They are confined, something I'll explain briefly. And they combine in triples to make the things that we normally play with. Our ability to calculate specific results from this theory is limited, but it's good enough to convince ourselves of its complete accuracy. I emphasize point particle constituents. It's kind of the whole point of quantum field theory is that it describes the quantum mechanics of entities that really have no more, there's nothing more to describe them than where they are in space and time. There are a few parameters that they can have that go along with that, like what's their mass, what's their spin, but beyond that, you can't say that they are made of something else. They are the modern world's equivalent of Mr. Euclid's point. They have no extension, and we really make use of that in essentially constructing the dynamic, the theory that describes their dynamics, the relevant quantum field theory. There's a cosmology track, which basically, of course, has been being explored for years, but the last 50 years have really seen a gigantic explosion in the power of cosmology. The recession of the galaxies was discovered long ago, almost 100 years ago now, and it suggests just kinematically a big bang event when everything was close together, exploded, and blew apart. And the reason why you see things farther away going faster is basically because, well, when the explosion happened, various velocities were imparted, and there's been a certain time since the explosion, and those that were going faster have gotten further away. The exploration of the thermal afterglow of this Big Bang explosion is now has yielded remarkable results. At the moment, it is a thermal so-called microwave background. It's just electromagnetic radiation of the kind that comes from your stovetop burner when you turn it on and it heats up, except that instead of heating up to, I don't know, 400 or 500 degrees, it's at 2.75 degrees Kelvin, almost absolute zero. Back at the time of the Big Bang, it was a heck of a lot hotter. Two surprises came out of the cosmology track of investigation. The matter of particle physics is there, but it is a minority player in the senses of where's the energy? Where's the beef? Where's the energy density in the world? There are two things that are not expected from the particle physics track. One of them is dark matter, and the other is dark energy. We can't tell you too much about what they are. The dark matter should be thought of as just basically dust, little particles that have very little, they have a mass, they can reveal their presence by gravitational interactions with the rest of the world, but they interact very weakly, if at all, with themselves and with us. They explain many, many puzzles of astronomy and also how today's universe coalesced from the Big Bang. They're a bit of an embarrassment for those of us who think that particle physics has really got the answer to everything. It's not included, as far as we know, in the standard census. But it's there, and we'll learn more about it without question. I probably will not go too deep into the standard model of cosmology, other than to say there's a timeline that we've been able to winkle out from observations of the temperature of the black body radiation on the night sky. What's plotted here is the so-called WMAP map of the temperature of the sky. And basically, I said the temperature of the night sky is whatever it is, 2.75 degrees Kelvin. What I'm plotting here is something that's varying. Well, this is, if you look at different directions in the sky, it's not everywhere exactly the same number. It varies a little tiny bit, like 1 part in 10 to the 5. So what's being plotted here are the differences from this average value at different places in the sky, and the fact that they come in patches. There are sort of biggish patches where they're all dark, and biggish patches where they're all hot by 10 to the minus 5 degrees above or below the average. That tells us an enormous amount of information, and from that we've been able to work out what is the census of energy in the, where is the energy stored? Back at the beginning, so to say, when this thermal radiation was first let loose, There's a pie chart here that tells you how the energy was disposed between dark matter, neutrinos, photons, and atoms, the stuff that we, you know, hydrogen atoms mostly, the stuff of which the visible universe is mainly constituted. And as time goes on, the expansion of the universe changed these energy densities, and dark energy, which is an energy of the vacuum, that curiously enough is of the nature, it's of a sign and a nature to cause the volume of the universe to expand without there being any particle substance present. It's just energy of the vacuum. Okay, let me spend 2 minutes on a discussion of method. Okay, so I've said that we have extracted all kinds of interesting things about how the universe is constituted, and in particular from this black body temperature varying across different parts of the sky. I said that we have in fact determined that at the time the black body radiation was let loose, basically, the energy constitution of the universe was distributed between dark matter, neutrinos, photons, and hydrogen atoms in a very particular way. We didn't directly see this, all right? All we see is that. We can do some statistical analysis on that and say, well, I take this data and I ask, well, on what angular scale is most stuff happening? And I get a plot like this. This is basically turning this into where's the variability as a function of angular scale that you're looking on. And from this, to learn about the underlying constituents of the universe requires a very important theoretical step. In cosmology and particle physics, we don't directly measure the hidden variables of interest. We have to have some underlying theoretical understanding that we are willing to really believe, and we use that to essentially, we use the data to infer what unknown numbers must be in this underlying simple model. We basically use statistical inference to see through the noise into the underlying physical parameters. And this is actually a very, a nearly universal method in modern physical science. And one of my messages is that biology is now entering an era in which it has to come to grips with this kind of method. Okay, so this is a bit of a side remark, but I think it's useful to have. We have this very comprehensive picture, which I grant you has a few tiny loose ends, right? The tiny cloud on the horizon that Mr. Kelvin pointed out some time ago. Massive resources were deployed to construct this picture. The current incarnation of these massive resources are the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva. And just to, you know, to give you a visual image of massive, this is the city of Geneva, there's the Geneva airport, there's Lake Geneva, and this white circle indicates the location of the tunnel where the ring and the magnets and whatnot are, that around which protons are whirled to a total center of mass energy of almost 14,000 times the rest mass energy of the proton. This is where the frontier experiments of physics, particle physics, are done today, and, you know, the when you smash these protons together at this energy, you have to build a very impressive detector in order to capture the debris and to measure their properties and to gather the data that you're going to do the, so to say, statistical inference on to find out what's the mass of the top quark or things like that. So here's the, I think this is the so-called CMS detector, and it's down in a pit some several hundred feet below the surface of the Earth, and these are actual people, not dolls, and so the machine itself, the detector, is pretty big. Okay, so the consensus picture is the outcome of an enormous effort, not just, so to say, physical capital, but intellectual capital was poured into this over a period of 50 years, and the sustained effort to answer what amounts to a question of natural philosophy, you know, what are the constituents of matter? Is quite remarkable, and I'd say it's a credit to the human race. I think we can be proud that we had the stick-to-itiveness to get this far. Okay, so where does theoretical physics go from here? Theoretical physics in the sense of finding the fundamental laws and identifying the players that march to the tune of the fundamental laws. Well, there are loose ends, and they're obviously more than loose ends, okay? But there is a certain sense where the program has succeeded so well that you are entitled to have some queasy feeling about how it's going to continue. On the conceptual side, we seem to be at something of a turning point. Once you're down to point particle constituents, you can't really explain them in terms of more fundamental entities. You change the nature of the question that you ask, that's for sure. There could be more massive particles out there that even the LHC can't see. And indeed, there are various obscure hints that there must be something beyond the precise framework of the standard model that we've got so far. And you know, going deeper in the light of string theory, we can see a natural limit point in how far you can go in the reductionist sense at the Planck scale, which is way beyond direct experimental reach. And on the experimental side, exploring the relevant energy scales is increasingly costly and surely in some sense approaching societal limits. So the LHC is doing great stuff, going great guns. We hope for surprises, and we did get confirmation that the Higgs, which is kind of the core element of the standard model, it's the particle that does the symmetry breaking and gives masses to all of the other particles. It had to be there in order for the standard model to hold true, but it took a while to actually physically see it, and that's now there. That's the primary thing the LHC has done so far. Looking beyond the standard model or in cosmology back into the inflationary epoch that, so to say, instantiates the bursting of the universe into life, the future experimental projects are in the 10 to the 10 euro or dollar class at least. Will taxpayers support them? Who knows? So at any rate, life is going to be hard for fundamental theory from here on. Not impossible, to be sure, but are there other paths that one might take? And what would you, by the by, I don't mean that one should abandon this path. There, as I say, there are important questions. People have ideas for how to pursue them. But I think life is going to get hard. And I think it's important to look around and make sure that you're not ignoring important questions that maybe would be a little bit easier to tackle. Okay, so that's the agenda of fundamental theoretical physics, so-called. There's another agenda, which is what I might say, not only, how shall I put it? Discovering the fundamental laws is the historic core, but in addition, you'd like to explain phenomena that you didn't directly build into the laws themselves, things that you might call emergent phenomena. For example, there is something called superconductivity, which people know a lot about here, and it's a macroscopic quantum effect. It's described by it's governed by the Schrödinger equation for many electrons moving in a lattice, in a material lattice. On the other hand, recognizing, or so to say, realizing directly from the equations of the motion of electrons in a quantum sense, that superconductivity is a possible outcome, was not something that leapt immediately to view. It took an invention stimulated by the existence of the phenomenon itself. You might want to prove confinement, namely that the quarks of QCD can never be seen outside the hadrons, the neutrons and protons of which they are constituents. Better yet, we would like to predict unknown emergent phenomena, derive them from the fundamental law, before their experimental discovery. Our record on this point has not been so great. The quantized Hall effect is a striking quantum effect and could have been predicted, but it wasn't. Doesn't happen often, but it's not impossible. Cosmologists did anticipate Big Bang phenomena like the cosmic microwave background. Topological insulators, a subject of great activity and interest in condensed matter physics these days, were also anticipated. So the good news, in any case, is that we have so far found that our fundamental laws are able to explain new emergent phenomena as they emerge, usually after the fact. Now, life, I would say, is the emperor of all emergent phenomena, to borrow and somehow deform the title of a recent book about cancer. There are phenomena of fundamental importance which are certainly described by the already known fundamental laws, but whose derivation from those laws completely escapes us. I would say the chief of these is life, living matter, if you will. And there are good reasons why it's time to bring the domain of living matter into the realm of predictive mathematical science. How living matter is governed by physical principles has always been a question for theoretical physics, but roughly speaking, I mean, there are many reasons why it's not developed as far as one would like, but I think one of the primary reasons is that data, the lack of facts, tied our hands. The ongoing explosion of quantitative biological data through high throughput sequencing, expression profiling, and a host of other things has created a totally new context for this issue. And on the biological side, it's becoming clear that we need mathematical frameworks like we have in physics to extract meaning from the growing mass of data. That plot of the little fluctuations of the microwave background temperature against the sky, well, that's the data that people got with their measuring devices. And it was only by, so to say, seeing how that fit into a mathematical framework of an underlying theory that meaning could be extracted from that. Biology is going to be, if it is not already, in the same position. So developing this kind of theory is what theoretical physicists do for a living. And, you know, the challenge posed by life, living matter, is a major intellectual challenge on a par with our quest for fundamental laws and difficulty. And so I come to the main subject of my talk. I would say I'm going to give you a quick tour of the past, present, and future of this enterprise. And I hope that in the process, I'll give you a more concrete idea of what I'm talking about. Before launching into this, I think it used to be said that there's no theory in biology, but I think the day may be coming when there is no biology without theory. So that's kind of I could have saved that for the last word, but I'll say it now. All right, so what about the past? Well, theoretical physicists have done some really good stuff for the world of biology in the past in various ways. There's a famous book called What is Life by Erwin Schrödinger, one of the founders of quantum mechanics, and in it he makes use of physical reasoning and known facts about at what rate mutations are caused by X-rays to basically conclude that whatever it is that's the unit of heredity, it has to be a molecule. It has to be that small, and it has to be. And I think he also basically concluded that a linear polymer molecule would be a pretty good idea because you could mix and match to essentially carry a message, information. In the 70s, John Hopfield, one of the heroes of condensed matter physics, and Jack Nino invented or realized the necessity for something called kinetic proofreading for DNA replication accuracy. We have a genome that's 3 billion base pairs long. Every time a cell divides, this genome gets copied. So there are 3 × 10⁹ options or opportunities for a mistake to be made. And if you do a simple-minded estimate of how often a mistake is likely to be made, because basically what makes you put an A in the place where there's supposed to be an A is that, well, it binds, there's a template molecule which you are attempting to reproduce, and where you're supposed to put an A, well, that's because the thing that is templating it is bound a little bit more by an A than by any of the other bases. So it's an energetic thing, and if you do a simple Boltzmann-like statistical mechanical estimate, you conclude that, well, you'd get a copying error of about one error per 10⁴ bases per replication event. And the actual rate is more like 1 × 10⁸, thank God. We only make a few mistakes each time we copy, not thousands and thousands. And this led them to propose an energy-consuming enzyme that basically checks fidelity and corrects mistakes. And this enzyme, its existence is real, and it was basically predicted. Okay, so this is the kind of thing that people who call themselves theoretical physicists have done that is significant and relevant to biology in the past. So what about what theoretical physics might be doing in biology in the future? Well, you know, this is pure speculation, but big questions are lying out there. They're way beyond our grasp today, but not, I hope, forever. And my, you know, a few of my favorite examples are, you know, what is it about non-equilibrium statistical mechanics, a subject that is a very active part of theoretical physics today? What is it, and it must describe what's going on in living organisms, what is it about that part of physics that makes it possible for populations of distinct, stably reproducing entities to arise? We hardly know where to begin in trying to answer this question. Can you capture the dynamics of a cell? Can equations accurately describe its behavior, given that a cell has thousands of interacting parts, and worse yet, that you'll never be able to actually determine what are the, you know, the numerical values to put on the various things that go into these thousands of interactions. Brains carry out tasks that are, you know, have a high-level abstract representation. Can we model a brain or even a simple sensory system that might be connected to a brain in a way that captures what it actually is able to do? These are some of the big questions that a future theoretical physics of biology would want to tackle. Today, we are not doing anything quite of that level of sophistication or ambition. We're doing warm-up exercises to prepare ourselves for the big task that lies ahead. So that's what I want to talk about, really. What are the things that we can do, and why are we doing them, and where are we going to go? So at the present, theoretical physicists, once they get hooked on biology, try to study issues that cut across the kingdoms of life, if possible, are suitable for non-trivial mathematical analysis in some way, and can be illuminated by modern biological big data. I mean, that's the change. You can get lots and lots of information, just like you can get millions of data points about what the universe was doing when it first emerged from the Big Bang. You can do similar things with living organisms today. So there are three big themes that I could talk about, and I'll try to talk about at least two of them. And these are themes that I particularly like. They're not the only themes that people are dealing with. So biological entities respond to stimuli, but noise in various ways it enters the functioning of organisms limits how much can actually be known, or how much any given organism can know, either about its surroundings or even about its own state. And so there are quantitative measures of information, Shannon bits, that are used in communication theory and just for general understanding of how information gets transmitted and measured and so on. Do making use of quantitative measures of information give us new views of how biological function or fitness and so on? There's another thing. Biological function often involves probability distributions on high dimensional data spaces. And these probability distribution functions must usually be learned from sparse data. How can you do this? I mean, there is one example that everybody has going on inside them and they don't know about it, and that is, you're looking around you and you're seeing something. You see people, you see faces, you see colors, you see shapes. That gets to you from your eye. Well, what is it that takes that information, that there's people out there sitting in various places of various colors and shapes? How does it get from your eye, your retina, to your brain? Well, there is a bundle of nerves that carry little spikes. That is to say, it goes tick, 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 tick. There are a million, roughly speaking, wires that are carrying such a series of spikes to your brain. And somehow that's the message that comes from your eye to your brain. And if you give the eye exactly the same input, you'll get significantly different outputs of spikes going down those nerves. Somehow what I'm seeing is a distribution of possible outputs of what goes down that that many-fibered pipe. So you, sitting around here, you're some probability distribution in the space of signals that can travel down the optic nerve. And understanding how that works and how you could decode the message to get the thing that really is important is something that is worth thinking about. The other thing, could high-throughput biological experimental data give access to the wheels and the molecular wheels and gears of cellular function using a similar strategy to what is common in particle physics and cosmology? I'll give you a superficial tour of what theoretical physicists are doing to attack a couple of problems that fall under these general headings, and I'll try and show in what way theoretical physics and biological big data are coming together. Okay. In order to give you this story, I have to just give you a quick summary of, or a quick tour of the basics of gene expression. How are genes turned on and off? Okay? In a cell, in your body, you have a chromosome. The chromosome contains the code for some 20,000 or so proteins. They don't all get made at the same rate at the same time. Only some of them get made at sometimes, and usually it's the appropriate time. How does this work? It's somewhat self-referential, but it works like this. This line is meant to be a stretch of the chromosome, and here is the stretch of the chromosome that contains the code for some particular protein. There is a machine, a protein called RNA polymerase, that sits down at the beginning of the information for this gene and chugs along the gene and pops out a message called messenger RNA that eventually gets turned by the ribosome into a series of amino acids that folds and becomes the protein. Just before the gene begins, there's a stretch called the promoter, which has some base pair sequence, and it has a very specific role. Namely, it's a place where another kind of protein called the transcription factor likes to bind. And the way this transcription factor knows that it wants to bind there is because it recognizes some shortish sequence of DNA bases. So it's a special protein that gets attracted to the DNA and preferentially sits at a place where a particular sequence is found. And clearly, this can do two things. It could either sit down where the polymerase is supposed to sit and start transcribing, in which case it turns the gene off. Or, if it's here, it could basically attract the polymerase. There could be some attractive interaction between the two. So there are two things of interest to you in this thing, and that is, well, what's the level of the output? What's the concentration of the protein that gets made? And how does it depend on the input, which in this case is the concentration of this regulatory protein, the so-called transcription factor? And if you can measure this sort of thing, what you find is an input-output curve that says, well, here is the concentration of the controller, this transcription factor, low here and high here. And here, when you change the value of this concentration of the controller, here's the concentration of the output. And lo and behold, when the controlling guy is low, the output is low. When the controlling guy is high, the output is high. So this is an input-output relation for a particular gene. And it has one feature that's important, and that is that it's kind of noisy. If you fix the input and measure the output a number of times, you will get different answers. You'll get some variability. And the variability can be plotted as a function of the concentration of the input. So it's a switch. It turns something off or on, depending on how big this concentration is. But it is a noisy switch. All right, so what does that do for us? So now I'm going to talk about one thing. That's probably all I have time to talk about. Building a fly embryo bit by bit. So this is a place where if you dig into it, you can see quantification of information doing something useful for you. So a fly starts out as a little millimeter-sized egg that has one nucleus in it, and a signal comes along, and this nucleus starts to divide and divide and divide and divide. And after an hour or two, you might have 10,000 nuclei in the place where you previously had one, all inside this little 1 millimeter sized egg case. Now, these nuclei are going to, at some point, start making decisions about their future. They have a fate choice to make. Some of them are going to turn into head, and some of them are going to turn into tail, or thorax versus abdomen. How does this work? Well, at the very beginning, before this process even starts, there is a gradient of one of these transcription factors called bicoid in the egg case. And I've plotted roughly what it looks like here. Up front, it's high. Towards the other side, it's low. Here, it's been visualized with some kind of fluorescent stain. And what does this transcription factor do? It controls the output of the nuclei of another protein, which is itself a transcription factor called hunchback. And here's the response of the nuclei to this varying concentration of this initial control protein. And you see that there's a region where they're all on because the concentration of the controller is high enough, and then there's a sharp transition and they're all off. Well, so somehow each individual nucleus is learning where it is and deciding what to do on the basis of its position, in effect by measuring what's the value of this driver, this bicoid protein. You can, if you're a clever experimentalist, you can in fact, for all the thousands and thousands of nuclei inside this egg at this stage, you can measure what's the value of the input concentration inside that nucleus and what's the value of the output concentration. So you can measure the distribution of the input-output pairs over the tens of thousands of nuclei and hundreds or thousands of eggs. Okay? Now, going back one slide, this is the actual, you know, this represents the actual measurement in the fly case. It's noisy, okay? You don't always get the same output. Sometime, if this is the place, if this is the concentration where you're supposed to switch from being a head to a tail, a thorax versus an abdomen, well, this noise is going to confuse you. So the question is, does this machine that connects together these two quantities, the input and output concentration, is it quiet enough? Can it do more than signal just on versus off? Does it do more? Is it capable of doing more than just what I've indicated here? Well, this is the kind of thing that you can at least begin to address with the help of information measures. So if you've got two quantities that can both be measured simultaneously in many, 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 many different realizations, their correlation, how they're tied together, is best quantified by mutual information. You can mutual information is a positive quantity. It's measured in bits. One bit means that knowing the value of the output will tell you not the particular value of the input, but just was it in the high region or the low region. You basically can distinguish two possibilities. If you have more bits, more discrimination is possible. Well, in this case for the fly, we have access to this correlation between these input and output quantities over many, many thousands of instances. And so you can actually evaluate this mutual information quantity. And you find that, well, the mutual information from the data is not one bit, not two bits, but 1.5 bits. So the fly nucleus is capable of doing more than being a simple on-off switch. Why is this? We're not entirely sure. However, this is where theoretical physics can come in and do something at least amusing. You can ask how big this mutual information could have been given what you know about the input-output machine. In other words, we've measured its properties and I get to choose the distribution. I don't get to choose in the egg what's the distribution of the inputs. It is what it is. But if I could imagine choosing any distribution of inputs I wanted with this known machine with its noisy properties, I could compute for you, for any given choice of the input distribution, what would be the mutual information between input and output, and I could ask for that distribution of inputs that gave you the best possible mutual information. So this is actually it's the kind of problem that physicists get to learn to solve sort of in the middle of their undergraduate education, and you can apply it to this particular case, and you can find, well, lo and behold, the maximum mutual information that these guys could have between these two critical quantities is 1.7 bits, pretty darn close to what it is in reality. Okay, so for some reason, this beast has decided to do, in some sense, almost the best that could possibly be done. In addition, you not only get this one number, which is some kind of, it's just a one number figure of merit, it's interesting, but you know, you'd like to know more, you actually get, when you do this variational problem, you get an answer which is, well, what is the distribution that achieves this? So that's what this plot is. This is basically saying, let's look at, this is a kind of, this is a histogram of what fraction of all the nuclei lie within different slices of level of expression of the output guy. So there's a curve, and you see that, well, there's a big peak here near zero. That's when the system is off. It's not producing any of the output. And here is on, it's high. And in between, well, you know, it's neither off nor on. In fact, so roughly 20% of the nuclei are neither off nor on, and that is essential for having mutual information bigger than one. And the red curve is the output of this variational problem, and the black curve is the data. So it's interesting, and it's the sort of thing that a theoretical physicist can't resist doing with this kind of data, and it does focus your attention on something that you would not have otherwise known, and namely that for some evolutionary reason, which is certainly worth pursuing, thinking about, this machine is, in the informational sense, almost doing the best that it could possibly do. And you can track this down a number of steps further and start asking more sophisticated questions, because not only does it have to know where's the head and where's the tail, it has to know where do the feet go, where do the different body segments in the abdomen go, and there are more than just two transcription factors that are involved at this stage. There's six of them or something like that. And you can start doing some interesting speculation about why it is that we need 1.5 bits for each of the players in this game. But I won't take you there. Let me give you my second story. So my second story has to do with probability distributions, and this is in the context of immune system diversity. Okay, so in your blood, you have lots and lots of red blood cells, but you also have amongst the white blood cells, you have things that are called T cells and B cells, and these are beasts that are the implementers of immunity, adaptive immunity. So you have many such cells, and these cells have surface receptors. So think of the cell, the T cell or the B cell, or any generic immune cell. It's a little blob. It's a standard cell. It's got a nucleus, but it also has, it has things sticking out from the surface. And in particular, it has surface receptors that are capable of recognizing things like proteins that are on the surface of a virus, or some fragment of some bacterial protein that's being displayed on the surface of one of your cells. And in zeroth approximation, it's not really true, but let's buy it for the moment, every single immune cell is different. Every single immune cell displays a different receptor. Why? Well, because you don't know what's going to be thrown at you. You have no idea, and you have to be prepared for anything, and the hope is that if you have a sufficiently diverse repertoire of these receptors displayed on your immune system cells, one of them, or some small group of them, will actually recognize the virus that is, you know, actually bind to the virus that is new and has entered your system. And if it does, it will proliferate and create a small army whose role in life basically is to gobble up these things that it's recognized as being pathogens, things you don't want in you. But the key to the whole thing is that somehow you get these immune system cells that in zeroth approximation, each one is different. I mean, the idea is each one is expressing a different protein in the form of a surface receptor whose goal it is to recognize a pathogen and attack it. And it's this diversity that makes the system work. Now, how is it possible? Because these surface receptors are proteins. Proteins are coded for by genes. And the dogma is more or less that, well, a gene is a gene. It's something that's coded for by a string of DNA in your chromosome. Well, these particular guys do something extraordinarily clever, namely, what's in the, so to say, germline DNA is not actually a gene for the surface receptor. There's a stem cell in your bone marrow that makes new immune cells. And in the stem cell, well, you know, there's a region of the genome that contains little elements that are going to be put together to make a gene that's eventually going to be expressed as something on the surface of the cell. And it's the Chinese restaurant menu, roughly speaking. There are a number of options in column A, a number of options in column B, a number of options in column C. And there's a clever enzyme that basically semi-randomly gloms onto one of the dishes in column A, one of the dishes in column B, and one of the dishes in column C, and so to say, brings them all together. So there's a certain amount of, and then when that's done, you have a cell that's got a gene for something that can be expressed on the surface of the cell as a receptor, which could recognize something. You know, there are the number of dishes in this restaurant per column is in, you know, a few tens or something like that. So you're not getting an enormous amount of diversity out of calling the waiter. The waiter, however, in coming back from the kitchen, or the chef in the kitchen, does a few other things besides just throwing together those three dishes. The chef chews away a little bit from the beginnings or ends of the gene fragments that were chosen. And another enzyme, just for the hell of it, throws in some randomly chosen bases in between. So when you put all of those things together, gene choice, deletions, insertions, a lot can happen. You can get a lot of different genes out. So you have about 10 to the 7 unique randomly generated immune cell types in your body. And it would be rather useful or interesting to see if you can quantify this diversity and understand in detail how it's generated. So that's the, you know, each stem cell event is a random event, and what's in your blood is it's a draw of a large number of instances from a machine that's generating stuff at random. So it's a probability distribution, and it's something which you'd like to learn a lot more about. Well, you know, can you actually go and see this thing in detail? No, you can't. But what you can do is harvest T cells from the blood, and in effect, using modern DNA sequencing technology, select out from the genome of these cells that have these varied surface receptor genes, actually get the sequences of those genes directly out. So if you get, you can readily get 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6th specific examples of what's the sequence of the result. So basically, you can't directly see, this is a little bit like this cosmic microwave background story, you can't directly see the machine that's doing the work, but you can see the output of the work. Does that do you any good? Well, yes. So this looks a little bit complicated, so I'll be very, how shall I put it, superficial in explaining it. But the idea is, roughly speaking, that every time a new cell is made, a small number of random types of random event occur. You make a choice of which one of these dishes in the three columns is chosen. You make a choice of how many insertions did you make between two of those dishes, and so on. And each one of them is some kind of probability distribution. There's different probabilities of choosing the different genes. There's different probabilities of making different numbers of deletions. There's different probabilities of making different numbers of insertions. It's a lot of numbers, none of which you know initially. On the other hand, the number of numbers that you don't know is very small compared to the number of examples that you can see in drawing from the blood. So the problem then, so if you knew these numbers, then you could say, well, for a particular scenario of what happened that produced a particular gene sequence, you could tell me, you could tell yourself what is the probability that this sequence actually gets made in a single shot event. Okay, so where theory comes in, if you like, is that, okay, the true component probability distributions are those that maximize the likelihood this collection of sequences that you actually got were made, all right? And this sounds like a horrible thing to do. You have to essentially make different choices for the values for these probability distributions and fiddle around until you get an answer that is the best you could possibly get for the probability that the whole collection got made. Turns out this is a very easy problem to solve with modern computer hardware and ideas, and you know, one gets some results. So for example, here is the probability distribution of the number of insertions between two of these gene fragments, just to show you the sort of thing that comes out. Namely, the probability of there being no insertions is small. It rises to some maximum somewhere. You know, it's most probable to have 4, and then it dies off. You can have all, with low probability, you can have quite a few insertions. These are more or less random choices of bases when you make, and so if you have a random choice of bases of 15 or 20 insertions of these bases, that's many, 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 many possible outcomes. So the total possible diversity is enormous. It's something like 10 to the 13 sequences. And the unique clones that we observe in our bodies come nowhere near to sampling the sequence diversity. We're able to get sharp results because we assume that the sequence diversity has a hidden source that's a lot simpler than what's coming out. And there's a kind of amusing thing that you can see, which is that, well, because there's such a large possible diversity, and because you have such a small fraction of that diversity actually present in you, if I take your blood and ask, well, you know, are these two human beings, or, you know, are they different? There'll be almost no overlap. Very few sequences will be shared between the two of you. And the question is, if there are some that are shared, and there typically are, does that mean anything? Or is it just random chance? Well, since you know what is the probability that any given guy, any given sequence, now we know, is produced in any one shot, you can in fact compute the probability that if I take a million of yours and a million of yours, one or two or three will turn out to be the same. And if I do find that there are two or three sequences that you have in common, I can ask, well, if this whole picture makes sense, it had better be the case that the ones that are in common are ones that intrinsically were likely to be produced. Okay, so that's what this little plot shows. The blue curve is a distribution of the probability, the generation probability of the whole ensemble, and the red curve is, well, I take a couple of individuals, I find the sequences that they have in common, and I say, well, what were their actual, this hidden number, the probability the sequence got made, and it comes, of course, from way up towards the top of the distribution. Okay, so this is fun. And these two things are examples of what a theoretical physics approach can lead you to. It's really adapting some of the attitudes, if not specific techniques, of modern particle physics and cosmology to the data that you get to play with in modern biology. So, okay, so why did I tell you these particular stories? Well, each is a specific instance of a broader class of conceptually simple problems spanning the tree of life and for which, you know, big data in quotes is available. So in the first one, well, information transmission problems are ubiquitous, and data adequate for quantifying how well it's transmitted can now be collected in many, many systems. And, you know, there are a whole bunch of problems that you should be addressing if you begin to understand how to quantify information in transmitting from one form to another. The correlated probability distributions on high-dimensional data spaces, the problems of learning them from sparse data are everywhere. I've mentioned the business about, well, your brain is getting a sequence of random spikes coming down the optic nerve, and it somehow turns it into the picture that you're seeing. I assume you're seeing the same thing I'm seeing, more or less, but you know, this is a problem that philosophers have struggled with over the centuries, and I don't know, you could be a figment of my imagination or vice versa.
That's what I need to ask questions.
This was a theorem, David will understand this. Johnny Wheeler is a great physicist, but a man of, and he was a fixture at Princeton for even longer than I have been a fixture, but he was certainly a more remarkable physicist than I am. And he had all kinds of quirks and foibles, and I had to say that he was, how shall I put it, he was the counterexample to the solipsist position. I could well imagine that I was a figment of his imagination, but there's no way he'd be a figment of mine. Such people are very valuable, right? They really nail down important philosophic positions. There's one that I can't fail to mention. We now have sequences for homologous proteins that do more or less the same thing in different organisms. Okay, so, and for some things, the number of organisms that have a protein that does roughly the same thing is in the thousands. You know, not millions, but thousands. And so, you know, you have an enzyme that catalyzes a specific kind of reaction, and you know that the one in E. coli is basically the same as the one in chicken. I mean, it's doing the same thing. And you look at the sequence. That's similar, but it's not the same. So you have thousands of examples of sequences of amino acids. You know, for each position there are 20 possibilities, and you go along for 100 places and you get the sequence of amino acids of some protein. And now you have 1,000 examples of, well, sequences that make a protein that does this particular enzymatic thing. It's clear that the protein is not defined by a specific sequence. It's defined by some statistical characterization of that sequence. Can you, from looking at these 1,000 examples, find the statistical rule that says this sequence is one that makes a protein that does this enzymatic thing? There's an extremely clever experimentalist who glommed onto this and in some mysterious way, in effect, took the 1,000 sequences and converted that into a black box, which no theorist was able to understand. But basically, you could push a button on the black box and it would produce a new sequence that had never been seen in the universe before. Because think of it, 100 amino acid sequence where each amino acid can have 20 different values, you know, the numbers of possible outcomes gets very large very quickly. And so he had a black box constructed on his principles that made sequences that he claimed were, you know, in the same class as the ones that were input. All right, okay. And they would look, if you looked at them, you could see that, yes, they really had some vague similarity. But he really nailed it in the sense that he was able to, you can now, given a sequence, you can actually make the protein. You can trick a bacterium into making it. So he took, you know, 50 examples or 100 examples and basically found that, well, yes, he was able to demonstrate that his black box had a very high probability of generating proteins whose sequence had never before, you know, nobody had ever seen a sequence of that particular nature before. And it did indeed have the enzymatic activity that the input guys did. So roughly speaking, the issue here is what defines a particular kind of protein? It's not a particular sequence. It's some kind of distribution on sequences. And can we figure out how to infer that from what are really a very small number of examples? He made use of a trick that all physicists will understand, but I won't explain it right now. Okay, second, these things that I told you about exemplify in various ways the theoretical physics method of understanding complex phenomena through inference of a much simpler underlying hidden but mathematically expressed mechanism. Okay, back to the future. Where are we now? First thing I would say is it seems blindingly obvious that biology is going to need some kind of general mathematical framework to organize the data flood that's in the offing. You know, medicine is going to, in hospitals, they are gearing up to collect the DNA sequences of everybody's tumors, who, you know, has a tumor taken out of them. They are going to collect gazillions of base pairs of data, and, you know, what is the mechanism for turning that into some kind of actionable medical information? I don't think anybody knows. I personally am quite skeptical that, you know, generic data mining approaches where you just say, we're going to somehow understand the data using abstract approaches a la Google X will do the job. I think that finding and using simpler underlying structures is going to be the key. And that's kind of, that's what underlay the examples that I spoke about. The deep problem is figuring out what complexities can be ignored in creating an adequate theory or model of a cell or a brain or an eye. And, you know, we have some vague ideas from physics, coarse graining, for normalization group, universality, and is it possible that such ideas or modifications and adaptations of them that work in physics have a role in biology? We certainly hope so. We also need to rise above specific models for each biological system. So right now, I mean, physicists are not the only ones who try to model and theorize and so on, but it tends to be because of the way our, you know, the level of understanding that we have is that we do a specific modeling for a specific system. And, you know, the number of specific systems and specific subsystems out there is getting pretty large, and we really are in need of some kind of view from a higher level, a 3,000 foot view of theory and modeling and biology. I don't claim that physicists are uniquely equipped for this kind of task, but they are naturally inclined to look for the generality we really need. So the concrete examples I described in the talk are a pretty pale imitation of the sort of analysis we will eventually need. They're just first steps. But the problem's a major intellectual challenge. It's just as hard. I hope it's deep, you know, as the fundamental physics challenges that we've solved in the past. And accepting it will ensure the future vitality of theoretical physics for sure. And I think it's really important for biology. And it's an adventure, and we have to. People are setting out on it, and they will no doubt fall on their face a lot. And eventually, 100 years from now, maybe something impressive will have come out of it. And nobody in the room will see it, but we can at least give it a little push and get the ball rolling downhill. Thank you.
Questions? Let David have the first question.
Ah, he gave me water and I didn't drink any.
So Kurt, our ex-colleague in Princeton, Rich Albert, an experimental physicist turned biologist, often says that to accomplish these goals, one is going to need new mathematics, new kind of mathematics. It's not just the mathematics that grew up together with physics, and to some extent was constructed to help solve problems of the physical universe. That living matter, in some extent, is quite different. It's obvious in some ways that it involves very disparate timescales from scale of chemical reactions to one's lifetime. These scales interact. That's not something physics ever had to deal with, really.
Well,
to a larger extent, we have the separation of scales. And then information plays a role in biology that it never plays in ordinary physics. So for those reasons, although he never explains exactly what he claims, that to achieve this truly new kind of mathematics will be required. Do you agree?
So, you know, in other versions of this talk for, or a talk like this for a physics audience, one of the things I say is that if you want to take up this challenge, you have to give up something that we all cherish, we theoretical physicists, beautiful equations, right? Beautiful mathematics that has been developed over the last couple of centuries and that we have learned, you know, somehow there's this mystical symbiosis between the laws of physics and mathematics, and it just goes on and on and on. It's going on in string theory and modern mathematics for the last 20 years. No beautiful mathematics has come out of this kind of thing yet. And it may very well need some kind of new mathematics, some kind of discrete mathematics. I mean, this is truly, I don't have a clear answer to this. When people actually try to do specific things now with what they've got in their head and what the data makes available, they use dumb old mathematics. In fact, mathematics of the kind that, you know, we thought was sort of dull when we were learning it in undergraduate school, ordinary differential equations and stuff like that. But, you know, there are mathematicians that get some really amazing results for, you know, inference of what's underneath some data structure, right? Some data is an interesting problem. So there are people like Terence Tao at UCLA, who have proven theorems about the ability to get exact results out of, so to say, noisy data under the right circumstances. Important theorems that are doing something new and deep are beginning to come out. They don't directly connect to this, but they are to some degree inspired, I think, by this general problem of, I want to find out some exact things about some underlying reality, but I can't see it directly. I can only see it through some noisy filter, as it were. How close can I come to the reality? Can I get the exact answer? Well, people are beginning to do things that are, how shall I put it, high-level mathematics that address that kind of issue.
I have a question. In your opinion, what are some subfields of biophysics that can yield some potential results to the ongoing energy problems or problems of sustainability or sustainable materials that can yield some help in this century?
Well, that's a fine question. I'm not sure that I have anything useful to say about that, although, let's see. There is a general thread in physical science, and why shouldn't it be carried over into biological science? The laws of nature permit various things. The world we live in provides materials that do interesting things, and they are what they are. You can, however, if you really understand things deeply enough, you can construct materials that have desirable properties that are not realized by any naturally occurring thing, right? I mean, people are doing things with graphene, let's say, that involve creation. One can create materials that basically you design by theoretical means, computational means, to have properties that you desire. If you knew enough about the dynamics of a cell, if you really could understand cellular dynamics at the same level that you could understand, you know, the transport properties of some exotic new constructed material, well, you know, maybe you could create much better photosynthetic cellular, so to say, living realizations of photosynthetic materials. Beyond that, I can't say.
I was wondering if you could tie some of the examples you've been giving to some of the recent work on drug-resistant bacteria.
Well, So you're, let's see, what would be the way to answer this? Well, drug resistance, I guess, is in some sense an evolutionary problem, and you're providing incentives to a evolutionarily highly plastic substrate, namely bacteria. You're providing incentives for them to learn how to beat your game. Again, you know, if you had a high enough level of understanding of the dynamics of evolution, of metabolic function and all the rest of that, maybe you could design molecules that would serve an antibiotic function that could not, you know, the bacteria have certain, for the moment, unbreakable rules about how they function and how they do their metabolic work, and you know, you could imagine designing something that would, satisfy a large number of constraints that, were you to try to explore them, these constraints directly experimentally, you would spend the rest of the lifetime of the universe sorting them out. Maybe with some computational help, you could find the right design criteria. I mean, people are doing, I mean, one of the things that was talked about in one of our seminars in this program that I'm here for was designing a vaccination strategy to, to vaccinate well. It's sometimes a good idea to essentially stimulate the immune system by more than one antigen. Which are the best, what's the best selection of antigens? Is there some value to having a particular sequence of application of these antigens? This is something which, it's an evolutionary question which gets to be, which you can address currently in a very rough and inefficient way with calculational means, but you know, if you acquired a higher level of competence in this area, you could do something along those lines.
Question in the back.
Hi, for those of us who are university educators, can you talk to us about the human resource development problem? It is hard to find a physicist who's had organic chemistry and biology. It's hard to find a biologist who knows differential equations.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I look back at my own personal history and I say, my God, how stupid could I have been? I was, you know, when I was an undergraduate, DNA had just been discovered. You know, just been the structure of DNA had just been elucidated, and you know, various people who were students at the time with me in the undergraduate college I went to, you know, went on to make important discoveries in biology. I did not take a single biology course. I did not take a single chemistry course. I was so totally focused on the wonders of the beautiful equations that you got to play with when you were doing theoretical physics that I completely missed. You know, one of the major major currents in science in the 20th century. I try to make up for lost time, but I'm virtually an ignoramus when it comes to chemistry and a total ignoramus when it comes to organic chemistry. What is amazing to me is tolerant the biologists that we physicists interact with when we try to do something in biology, how tolerant of our ignorance they are. So we must be offering something that they find useful, because we certainly put our foot in our mouth over and over and over again. To try to be a little bit more serious about
it. I was going to stop you right there while you were ahead. So let's thank Kurt, and I want to remind everybody. We have some light refreshments on the way out to the courtyard, so please continue to get refreshed.